Welcome to Regulating AI Podcast, hosted by Sanjay Puri. Join us each episode as we dive into the evolving world of AI governance with global leaders, exploring how to responsibly tackle AI's challenges while fostering innovation and balance. Welcome to Regulating AI, the podcast that brings global, diverse voices together to discuss fair and responsible AI regulation worldwide. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have the privilege of speaking with Professor Emma Rudkamp-Bloom, a leading figure in AI ethics and policy. Emma is the current chair of UNESCO's World Commission on the Ethics of Scientific Knowledge and Technology and a member of the UN Secretary General's Advisory Body on AI. She played a pivotal role in drafting the UNESCO recommendation on the ethics of AI, which was adopted by 193 member states in 2021. With her extensive background in philosophy, ethics, and AI policy, we have a global audience. Our audience is, you know, made up of policymakers in the US and Europe, across the board, think tanks, entrepreneurs, AI passionate folks, etc. So can you talk a little bit about your journey into the field of AI ethics and what inspired you to pursue this path?
Yes, thank you. I started off actually as a philosopher of science, working on scientific realism and applying mathematical logic approaches such as non-monotonic logic to try and bring different perspectives to some obstacles in the then conversations on scientific realism, which was towards the end of the 90s when I was working on my PhD. I worked in that kind of environment, moving a little bit to philosophy of technology at times, but I also taught formal logic to symbolic logic to BSc artificial intelligence students at the University of South Africa in the computer science department. And that brought me into contact with many people working in the then logic-based AI, well, it still exists, but that was the main approach to AI in those years. And through that, I became a member of the Center for AI Research in South Africa, which is a distributed center among 9 universities and which is multidisciplinary. I was never really, maybe I shouldn't say that, interested in the social aspects. I loved working with the symbolic stuff and thinking about science and, you know, okay, how it relates to reality, but more about the testing and so on. But then when the data-driven boom happened, you know, and one can, different people will give different dates, but, you know, let's say here it happened, it really started making an impression on me towards 2011, 2012. I started realizing that being on this side of the world in South Africa, we really have to start thinking very hard about what the impact of the data-driven version of AI is and how we can become a part of it. We were already, because there were people working at the center in this area, but thinking more generally in terms of vulnerable populations and also thinking in terms of jobs, because I'm also head of department in philosophy at University of Pretoria, and I take seriously that I have a responsibility to think about the careers of my students. So I started the research group in ethics of AI. I got involved with UNESCO. They came across my name at the center, and, well, you know, one thing led to another. I'm very much involved in policy work nowadays. I do very little in philosophy of science, pure philosophy of science, hoping to go back to that at some point, but at the moment, very much focused on machine ethics issues and policy issues.
Wow, that's a pretty wide area that you covered. Emma, one of the things that we try to do on this podcast is really get some global perspectives. You know, I'm based in Washington, D.C. You are in South Africa. You know, people talk a lot, and we're going to have this conversation today. But not too much conversation happens about the global South. And I'm really hoping that we have that conversation because we have, you know, it becomes a U.S.-centric or a EU-centric, in many cases, conversation, especially about AI and AI regulation. So really, we are very, very thrilled to have you. Now, you talked about your role at UNESCO. For our audience that is not familiar, can you explain the significance of UNESCO's recommendation on the ethics of AI, and how is it shaping the global AI governance?
I think it's one of the most important documents that we have as guidelines in terms of thinking about global governance of AI at the moment. And I say that because it was the first global approach to thinking about what AI ethics should be, involving, when I think about the ad hoc expert group that drafted this, we were four people out of each of the six regions of UNESCO. And from all walks of life, different backgrounds, different age groups, different genders, different career paths. And this is what UNESCO stands for. So it was a really, truly global conversation, firstly, which is really important, which had not happened at that time. And secondly, what is important is that it did not give at that time, around 2020, 2021, there were a lot of, hundreds, literally, of guidelines with values and principles and nothing else. The recommendation includes policy actions. The biggest part of the recommendation is on policy actions and how to concretize the principles, which are already putting the values in more concrete terms. And that is a really important contribution because we focus on different sectors to explain what is needed in the main sectors that we identified, such as labor, such as gender, such as the environment, which were also at that time, the environment was not something that had been highlighted in AI ethics conversations. And then the last thing that is really important is that UNESCO from the beginning committed to support member states in adopting and implementing, well, not adopting, but in implementing the recommendation. Because what we realized, because of the intercultural conversations, was that obviously different member states will be at different stages of readiness to implement the recommendation. And it is in that kind of realm that one has to be really culturally sensitive, and one has to think about very, very widely about what kind of factors could possibly affect a readiness status. We defined that as a moving status on a continuum of dimensions. And UNESCO developed then the readiness assessment methodology, which is a tool that member states can use to determine the readiness at a given stage. And then also there is an ethical impact assessment tool, which is very far from just a tick box exercise. So it opened conversations. There was a global forum of AI that UNESCO hosted and organized in Slovenia in February this year. And it is very clear that member states across the world are thinking very hard about, the conversations that opened up around the recommendation. And there are, let's say 50 to be safe, but I actually think it's closer to 60 member states that have already gone through the readiness assessment exercise, which I think is something to be very proud of.
Wow, so 60 states have already gone through this exercise. That's very impressive. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
May I add one thing? I just want to say one more thing. Mm-hmm. And what is also exceptional about the recommendation is that it included a value that is not a typically Western value for the first time. And that is the value speaking about living, what it came out to after the negotiations. Mm-hmm. But it is about living a life of value in a relational way. So understanding that the notion, and this doesn't only come from Africa, it comes from the East as well, but the notion that I am because we are. So whatever happens impacts every person on the planet. And this was something that was not so easy to work into the recommendation and to keep there. But in the end, it stayed there, and we are very proud of it.
So for the first time, you got culturally sensitive impact into this readiness assessment. So there is now an ethical readiness assessment tool that is available, so to speak, for countries, Emma. This is for our listeners to know. That is very, very good. And we want to later on talk a lot more about culture, because that's something of great interest to our listeners. But Emma, as the chair of COMEST, what do you see as the most pressing ethical challenges in AI development and deployment, if you were to list some for our listeners?
Not a very easy question, but I have to say that in the domain of AI, which has to be understood, is that whenever we say ethics, we think in term, we are saying politics and we are saying society.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the biggest threat is the widening of the inequality gap. You know, it is easy to say that no one should be left behind. As things stand at the moment, millions of people are going to be left behind if we don't get our act together. So, and the main, one of the reasons, there are many reasons, obviously the power play that in the end, you know, steers what happens in terms of AI technology. There is the business model that steers AI technology that is focused on the modification of data for profit, but it's focused on geostrategic power balances as well. And it has the extra layer of bringing the private sector into these kinds of relations, which is new, but which keeps on happening with emerging technologies in climate, in space exploration, it's everywhere now. Quantum computing, we have to find ways to deal with this. But when people, the most important driver of this for me is actually the way in which people talk about bias in data sets. They talk about it as if there is something, as if this is a deviance from the norm and the norm is a neutral data set. There is no such thing. We are using human data. Humans are biased beings. So there is a political codification in any data set. So what we have to be sensitive for is what is the story being told in that political code that is hiding behind the data? That is what is important. And together with that, I mean, obviously, I can say lots of concrete things in terms of Africa, you know, in terms of penetrability, in terms of internet connection and connectivity. South Africa had huge electricity problems for a while. We seem to be out of it, you know, really touch wood. But so I can say stuff like that. And it is important. And I really think that connectivity should be a basic human right in the era in which we live. But what is also important is that we think about bias in the right way, and then that we fight with everything that we have, the exclusion of the global south from global conversation on AI. It has been addressed in various ways. I mean, I gave UNESCO as an example. The UN advisory body also drew people from across the world. And I'm proud to have been there as somebody who has lived for more than 50 years in Africa. Close to 60, actually. So I think, and there are different ways in which we should fight that. And one way I would just say is language. To portray the global south as consumers of AI technology fits certain narratives. We are not just consumers. We are also producers of this technology, and we have the right to be producers of this technology. For me, that's the biggest issue. There are other issues. I must say one maybe that's really important is access to training in STEM disciplines and the gender imbalances, as far as that is concerned, across the world, not just in the global south. It's very go and do a gender check in Silicon Valley, in the big tech companies, and you will be astounded, or a diversity check. So those things are also really important. But yeah, so let me stop. I mean, there are many, but those two for me are the most important ones.
So you touched on some very, very important topics, Emma, and hopefully we can get into it a little bit. One is your worry about millions of people getting left behind, as you said, about Global South, you know, not being in the conversations. Obviously, as you said, there are some challenges, and we want to talk a little bit about that. But do you think now So I'm going to address that topic, and then you talked about the geopolitical nature. And we have a lot of, you know, we have senators, members of Congress, etc., that come on our show from the U.S. and around the world. So I want to touch on that topic too, because that's become a very, very important issue in the U.S. at least. But talking about the global South, and this is for, you know, talk to our listeners in the U.S. and Europe who are maybe, you know, not as familiar. Aren't those conversations now being held at places like G7, G20, even at Davos and others? So do you see more needs to be done? And when you say Global South, is there a voice for Global South per se? Because Global South, you know, if you were to ask an American what is Global South, they couldn't tell you in many cases what is the Global South. So, okay, so let's say there is the Global South. Should they have a unified voice? And then the other thing is, what else can be done, according to Emma, to get the voice of the Global South in these discussions so that millions of people don't get left behind? So this is for our audience that, you know, we have members of Congress who listen. We have their staff who listen. So this would be a chance for you to tell them.
Do you think there's more openness towards these kinds of conversations at the fora that you mentioned? But there can never be enough openness because there is a huge deficit. So we have to make up for time that has been lost. And, you know, we can speak the rest of the day for why the time has been lost, why the Global South is excluded. But maybe, you know, let's not focus on that too much, although it really plays a role in terms of the business model that at the moment drives AI technology, which is something that, from my point of view, should change very fast. And even if it only changes in the Global South, because you know what? In the next 20 years or so, if you look at the World Economic Forum statistics, a very large part of the population of the world will be African. We are changing the world in which these young people will live and in which they will make decisions. And they have a right to be taken seriously, and we had better take them seriously, quite frankly. So for that reason, I think we can never have enough. I don't think it should be a unified voice. The situation in Africa is not the same as in Latin America, is not the same as in parts of Asia. And also, even just on the African continent, I mean, we have huge differences. We have, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of dialects. We have different cultures. We have different economic situations. We have different political situations. But we can speak with one voice if we have to. And I don't think it's a unified voice. I think it is voices that should be heard. And it's really important also, if we think in terms of something that's also important from a Kumest point of view, for instance, is digital literacy. But we should be talking about digital literacy. There are different approaches, different ways of making meaning or of meaning making in terms of how people engage with this technology. And everybody is impacted, even those that don't exist as data points, because they don't exist as data points. So, yeah, you know, so we not unified, change the language, get everybody involved and listen, because you know what? We have a lot to offer. We have a lot to bring. And there's a lot of innovation happening on this side of the world and a lot of really hard thinking in terms of governance that would enrich current conversations that, you know, might become a little bit monotone if it's just the same people saying the same things over and over again.
That's helpful. I want to touch on another important point that you brought up is language. The current language of AI to a large extent is English, because it's coming from Silicon Valley, from the US. Now, to a certain extent, let's just say in Europe with Mistral and a few others. How important is for our listeners is language, whether it's from a cultural issue or just bringing people along, because I have had Europeans who are afraid their entire cultures, like in Finland and others, are going to get left behind and get wiped out because if AI just becomes a language of English. But Africa has, as you said, so many different dialects. So tell our listeners, why is language important from a cultural and from an AI standpoint?
From a cultural point of view, because it's about values. It's about the way in which life is approached. We express our culture in our language. If you think about, people say French is very, very idiomatic. Okay, what does that say about the French way of living? So it carries over to how you find yourself in the world, how you experience your world, and how you navigate the world that you find yourself in, and how you try to shape it in ways that you can deal with. So it is exceptionally important. And unfortunately, this issue is obviously exacerbated. I share the concern of countries like Finland, but it's exacerbated on this side of the world because it goes hand in hand with being invisible, with the data poverty, with not having access to maybe the necessary levels of compute. So it is exacerbated. So in terms of language, in terms of values, in terms of culture and values, language is really important. Language is also important in terms of AI, because we should think about changing the business model. Having said that, now you have to understand something. So we say, okay, we want, and we have many, many entities like that. We want to build grassroots communities that build natural language processing, say, applications for particular indigenous languages. We have Lelapa AI in South Africa. We have Masikani natural language processing. There are many examples. I give the South Africans ones because I'm proudly South African. But what happens then is that you have to take into consideration that you have a huge responsibility if you start working on building such applications on the data of people that have not existed necessarily as data points before. You have to protect their dignity. You have to protect their privacy. You have to protect their culture. You have to be transparent with what will happen to their language if it becomes, in this way, part of the AI world. So it isn't something that can ever, and nothing in AI could and should ever be done without responsibility. So one should we also be able to reflect on this, but that it's needed and that Africa can play a huge role in this respect is really important. Hopefully it will happen with emphasis on retaining ownership of data. I cannot stress that enough. We can talk long stories about data colonization. It's a real thing. And we should stand very strong against that. Let me just say that, but be proud of owning your own data. Don't give it away without thinking. And governments should take this seriously.
So owning your own data is important, and language defines culture, as you've said. You touched on another point, which is a current theme right now in Washington is the geopolitical issues of AI. It's become a very important and a sensitive subject. And there is a perspective that, that there are national security implications of AI. And do you believe the Global South is going to get caught in the middle of this whole geopolitical challenge? I mean, putting it bluntly, it's the geopolitical challenge of in AI is the United States and, so to speak, the Western world framework against, let's say, China, for example. So where does the Global South fit in here?
I can give two answers. One is nowhere. And the other one is it has a role, but the place for it in the current business model is to see it as a dumping place for labor, attitudes. If you think of the so-called ghost workers of AI, if you think of all the people driving the reinforcement learning aspects of generative AI who are living in very bad conditions, who are not treated according to international labor law. The AI business model needs a dumping site in that sense. It needs a place where it can go to get cheap labor to do things fast. And, you know, one should maybe not say that, but one should actually shout it from the rooftops because that is what it is. That's the truth of it. So if you think in terms of geopolitical concerns and you think about national security issues, and you think about also, of course, data sovereignty and sovereignty of states, all of those concepts are in a sense, and you know, it's frightening to say this, but are in a sense up for grabs. We should protect the national sovereignty of states, but we should retain the ability to get together to address global issues. And one such issue is the use of AI in the military domain in general. It's not, you know, robots walking around with guns. It's much more subtle, much, much more subtle. That's why we need voices from the global south so that we can ensure that we are not nowhere in this power play. And that we can change it, that we can disrupt it. Because we are talking about a disruptive technology anyway, many things have to be disrupted in terms of how we see the world, so that we can have a truly global world order if we talk about AI technology.
So what you're saying is, one point you said is Global South is nowhere, but in some cases, it's also becoming a dumping ground. And I think, Emma, what you were referring, so that our audience can understand, is that whole controversy of where labor in Africa has been used for data labeling and things of that nature, especially when they've had to deal with some really horrible data applications that really could cause mental stress and those kinds of things. Emma, you brought up a point of military applications. So I want to just follow up on that point. Is what are your thoughts on the ethical implications of AI in military applications?
Okay, that's also something that I can talk about for the rest of the day. But let's, of course, the ethical implications are also political implications. You know, the ethics of AI is the politics of AI. We have to understand that. The biggest concern for me is the problems around transparency and the power that the different guises of surveillance, of digital surveillance, and the different roles that misinformation can play. So yes, we you know, one big topic is the lethal autonomous weapon systems and big concerns around should basically mathematical algorithms be allowed to kill people. And, you know, we can have lots of conversations about that. And, you know, would that be with a bit fewer mistakes than humans would make, no feelings of guilt, all of those things, really important. But we miss what is happening in front of our eyes. And it's not just cybersecurity. There are many different ways in which artificial intelligence technology is used to disrupt national security of sovereign states. And we have to understand, we have to learn to recognize this. I really think it's important that there is awareness around this across the world in all governments, and that this is something that is taken into account together with data ownership and other concerns that I've mentioned already by governments to work with companies or entities from the other side of the world to build a data center in your country. What is it that you're going to be giving up? So for me, it's a very wide issue, much wider than just concerns around human dignity. You know, it's not just about robots killing people. It's a lot more subtle than that, but a lot more dangerous at the same time. And it's happening, it's here. It's the biggest threat to safety and security globally, and it should be taken very, very, very seriously.
So what you're saying is we need to definitely take it seriously, and that data sovereignty is very important. You touched on one point, and I want to just bring up data centers. You know, right now, they are the topic du jour. So to speak, these hyperscalers are setting up data centers around the world. Singapore has probably the second largest. Now they're going across Malaysia. And I've seen that Kenya has become a big location for data centers where Microsoft and I think A42 have put some major investments in there. Do you see that as a good thing? And it's Kenya because data centers need several things. They need land, okay? They need energy, they need water, and they need basically those are some of the infrastructures things they need. Any thoughts on whether there should be more data centers? But then you are also coming up on this conundrum of energy and sustainability that comes up that you talked about earlier. So just quickly, some thoughts on data centers since you brought it up.
If you think in terms of global governance concerns and you think about sharing the benefits of AI globally, because everybody is contributing to AI technology, not because one part of the world is consumers and the other part is producers, the huge amounts of data that the current trend in terms of AI technology needs is, for most countries, it is not possible to be a role player on that level. So what we need is bilateral, multilateral collaborations in terms of data sharing, but of course with many things in place, not just data ownership, many other things. We need it, and I think it's a good thing, and I think it is sustainable in Africa because it will, it will. There's like, on the other day I read a document that said there's 177 data centers that are going to be constructed on this continent within the next decade by various big role players. We do need them, but apart from the natural resources, they of course need funding and they need talent. We have a lot of talent in Africa, but we need more because of the way in which the population is growing, and for many other reasons. So I think for me, the most important thing is, yes, data centers are important, but again, data sovereignty should never become data localization. So do not sell your soul for the data center. Think about your population first, think about your ownership, think about what is it that you're really trying to achieve? Do you want to be prescribed to? For what will be processed, what it will be used for, those kinds of things. So I really hope that governments on this side of the world will think very clearly and rationally when they make these kinds of decisions. And
Emma, you work with the African Union Development Agency and the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. And you mentioned in the future how Africa, with its young and growing population, is going to play a key role. What key insights have you gained about AI governance in Africa from those roles? This is for our listeners who might not be as familiar.
I think I've mentioned a lot of them. I think what is really important is that we should push to make our voices heard, that we should ensure that there are African voices, that we should prove that we also can put our money where our mouths are. So in the sense that when we say that we have talent, when we say that we are also producers of AI technology, to be able to show this. And we should work very hard to get there. We need to fix a few things. I'll mention two. One is education and training. And this is really, really, really important. We have excellent universities and centers of technology in Africa, but we do not have enough. And Africa is huge. So it's very difficult and it has different communities. It's not all cities. How to do that is, for instance, not to fall for hype from big tech that will tell you that generative AI is the solution to all the problems for rural communities who never had access Well, you know what? If they don't have access to schools, they might not have access to electricity. They might not be connected. They might not have the devices needed. And maybe they're not interested because their values and their culture will not feature in the knowledge that is created through generative AI applications. Not knowledge, by the way. I don't think it is knowledge. But yeah, so we have to be aware. We have to think very, very seriously about how to revolutionize the way in which we think about education in Africa. And they also, we need to make bilateral and multilateral agreements and help each other so that we can address this issue. The other issue obviously has to do with problems related to poverty, problems related to energy, problems related to, you know, something that people don't think about, but something like food security. So the situation in which people live determines also how seriously they think about things like technology. For some people, this is really, I mean, can I just have food on my table for my children today? Thank you very much. So we have to understand that also, and we have to address those kinds of issues. And in that context, really think about connectivity as a basic human right for Africans.
So you made some very important points. Education, training, you talked about, obviously poverty, food security. But education and training, which is also an important thing in the US and other countries too, because this involves reskilling of a workforce. And you talked about how, especially in rural communities, is there a role for remote education, online education? Because now, why have the students come, and you are at a university, so I don't want to take your university's work away, but why have students come to universities when universities can go to the students, Emma?
Yeah, well, that is a really hard question. I think it is because maybe we should just take a lot, well, not maybe, definitely, we should take a lot more care in what quality of remote learning is like. There is a lot still to be said for creating knowledge as a social construct, as something that happens only in groups, that happens only in interaction, and you can walk up to a person and quickly say something, and you can read their body language. So for those kinds of things, I think in-person contact of some form is still really important. Humans are social beings, but that remote education can play a really important role, stands, you know, as a fact. But again, obviously, on my side of the world, we need to fix the connectivity and those kinds of issues first. And we have to take care how much surveillance we allow into the conversation. If you think about all the court cases around the Proctorio issues, we have to be careful. We have to be very, very, very careful. Well, what is it that we allow? What is it? Are we objectifying our students? Do we have the right to do that in return for quality education? So none of these issues are just simple issues that we could just say, yeah, this is the solution. AI for good. This is the way to go. It is not just an easy path. It might be the way to go, but it will always ask for a lot of reflection and a lot of thinking around responsibilities and transparency and accountability.
Well, that's absolutely the group dynamics plays a key role, not just in education, but just building yourself up. Just shifting to you had a tremendous role with UNESCO, and you talked about it earlier, but in the US, there is some level of skepticism of international organizations. But so what do you believe that international organizations like UNESCO should play in the global AI governance?
There is a role for them. Being a member of the UN advisory body, I'm very much aware on a really personal level, maybe more than I was before, of this kind of resistance. And some of it is certainly justified. Some of it is not. Some of it is playing and reacting to hype around this technology. And we have to be very, that's why we have to be clear-headed when we think about AI. I think there is a role because many of these intergovernmental organizations have the machinery to do things that cannot be done by the private sector. Yes, it's on the one hand a drawback. For instance, if you think in terms of UNESCO, I haven't played a big role at UNESCO, at a very small part of a small part of UNESCO. I just want to say that. But if you think of UNESCO, I mean, everything that is done, everything that is written, all the reports are addressed to member states. So there is a need to also speak to civil society organizations. And at CUMEST, when we have our conference every year, we invite civil society organizations, and we're working very hard to change the kind of balance of how much input they can actually make at these conferences. So, but again, those kinds of entities have sometimes a lot of what is already needed to make changes in how they work and to reach out to many more people at once than can maybe be done by just one private sector entity or one civil society organization. The way for me, the way forward is, interconnecting, and that's, that was part of the value, the non-Western value in the UNESCO recommendation, the interconnectedness of everybody, interconnecting these kinds of intergovernmental entities with civil society organizations and with the private sector, and taking care on who calls the shots, because it should be a joint endeavor. Should not be handed over to one of these. So I think that in that sense, there might be a lot of change coming in how these kinds of entities should operate, but that we still need them, I think, yes, we do.
So there is a role for it, not an exclusive one. Emma, EU passed the EU AI Act. In the US, we're not going to pass anything. We're in a presidential race, and in the conversations that we've had with leaders here, they believe we need a low touch. We want to keep innovation going. Do you think Africa or the Global South or African Union will have their own AI act, so to speak, or they're going to kind of rely on or with the AI, EU AI Act or stuff? This is people, these are some of our listeners want to know this from you. Is there going to be something coming from Africa?
Yes, there is something already on the table from Africa. There is an AI strategy for the continent that was developed by the African Union, and there are also other, can't find the word, processes continental wide at the moment. There is a white paper. And no, we don't want to rely on the EU Act. Yes, the EU Act is really important for us. And I'll tell you why, because it is the first regulation that addresses the transboundary and nature of big tech. So there are ways now to keep them accountable across borders. And this is sorely needed for many reasons. And this, because one of them is that, and this is also why global regulation is important, this might be the only protection that some people will ever have in some parts of the world. So it is important. It's also important for the transnational nature of it. It reaches beyond the borders of the EU. But we don't want to rely on that only. We want to have our own strategy, and we want to have our own act. It will look different from the EU because there's a lot more diversity in Africa. And I'm really really hoping that our strategy will be built on a different kind of business model. But we will see how far that kind of idealism goes. But yeah, no, certainly we're working on our own stuff, and we have our own stuff going
Great.
strongly.
So for our listeners, there's something in the works and it'll come hopefully soon. They might get inspired by the EU, but it's going to be based on their own conditions that exist in Africa. Emma, you have obviously, you wear so many different hats and so many different interests. One of the things that fascinated me is that you have the intersection of technology and humanity is a kind of a recurring theme in your work. How do you envision human technology relations evolving? I mean, you also have talked about the impact of robots and things like that. And we've had some incredible experts in this area that have come in. But just if you can just briefly touch on that, because that's an area for our listeners that are very interested.
I think something that we have to realize is that we have, as humans, always interacted with tools, with technology of some kind to shape the world in which we live, to make that world navigatable, to make that world livable. So it is not something new. What is new with AI is simply that it touches us in so many different layers of our lives and that it touches everybody. That it does, you can't hide. You have the right to be forgotten, but that definition is shrinking and shrinking because, if just think in terms of the technology, if your data has been used to train a model, you cannot delete your data. People say they will do it, they are not telling you the truth. So it's a characteristic, is a natural human trait to, in some way, use technology to shape the human world, our life world, as it's called in post-phenomenology, which is a field of thinking in philosophy. But we have to understand that it's not just a shaping, there is a co-shaping. Technology shapes us right back. And that is where things become really interesting. What kind of a role do you want to give to technology in the co-shaping of the world in which you find yourself? Because it co-shapes your moral values, whether you want to believe it or not. Really important work and interesting work done on this. But, if Alexa, the default voice is female, what message is being sent out? So it's very, very small example, very, simple example, but it explodes. So what kind of a role do you want to give it? What kind of a role do you want to give it in art, in your experience of art, in the creation of art? There's a lot of really important work being done in the performative arts with the help of AI technology. And what does it mean that technology can shape the way in which we experience art? Well, it has. A piano is a technology. But now it's different because it's more personal. So, I really think that we should all keep on thinking, and lots has been written about this in academia, and I won't bore you with that. But there are many different voices thinking from different fields about this. But it is something that we should maybe put also to ordinary people in the street to think about how it is that they are interacting with technology and what role is that they are allowing technology. You will not allow somebody that you don't trust to have an impact on your life. If you think about how passionately young people talk about relationships and trust, okay, does that carry over to the way in which you interact with technology and the role that you allow it in your life? And if not, why not? At least have an answer. Those kinds of questions I think are really, really important for everybody to reflect on.
Yeah, the role of, it's taking over, no matter what age group you are and where you are, it's taken over our life. Emma, I have like maybe 60 other questions and I could go on and on. I think we'll need to have you come back again. But towards the end, we do a lightning round of questions. These are just one word answers. Let's see what your thoughts are. We've covered a lot of ground, so you ready?
Yep.
Okay. Innovation or regulation, what should come first for AI?
Together, they should come together. Can't have the one without the other.
Okay. Global or regional approach to AI governance?
Regional,
Okay.
informed by global, but regional.
Okay. A centralized or decentralized framework for AI regulation?
Decentralized.
Okay. I think I know what you're going to say, but let me give it to you. It's human rights or economic growth? What should AI prioritize?
Human rights.
Okay. Public or private sector, who should lead in the AI ethics development?
You know what? I want to say none. Civil society should lead it.
Civil society. Good answer.
Yes.
Should there be universal or culturally relative AI, Emma?
Both.
Okay. Should there be transparency or performance? Which is more crucial for AI systems?
Transparency.
Okay. Precautionary or permissive approach to AI development?
Precautionary.
Okay. Final one. What do you think? Will it be cooperation or competition that will drive global AI development?
Afraid it will be competition, but it should be collaboration.
Okay. That's fantastic. Emma, finally, for our global audience, as I said, we've covered a lot of ground and there's so much more I wanted to cover. Can you give some, action items, some thoughts? What gives you hope for AI governance? What are the areas you are most concerned about? But some action items that our audience can take from this very, very important conversation we had today.
Let me start from a high level. I think we should take a lot of care to not be taken up by some of the current false dichotomies in the narrative around AI, ethics versus safety, harm versus risk, innovation versus regulation. And the reason why I make the choices that I made in this lightning round of questions is because the only sustainable AI technology is responsibly deployed and, well, designed first and then developed and deployed and used AI technology. We want it to be sustainable. If you want to have talk about AI for good, you don't want it. You don't want to have millions of court cases. You don't want people to die. You don't want people to sit with serious mental health issues. You want to think about intergenerational justice. You want to have a better world. So that is why the one is necessary for the other. And these false dichotomies, think whose conversations are you furthering when you fall for them? And then moving down to every person. If you think back to the Enlightenment there's a difference, but depending on who you speak to, but 1600s, 1700s, to try and satisfy everybody. The slogan for the Enlightenment was have the courage to think for yourself. And that is more true than ever. Engage with AI technology, embrace AI technology, but think what it is that you are embracing, how you are allowing it into your life, what it is that you allow it to do, and what you should not allow it to do. I think I can go on, but maybe.
Well, so I think there are some great action points. Embrace the technology, allow it, but think for yourself and see what it can do for you. Great points. Thank you, Emma. Really, those invaluable insights are just incredible. Your work really, the intersection of philosophy, ethics, and AI policy, especially bringing the views of the Global South, the diverse cultural values and human rights was very, very enlightening. And as we continue to navigate the rapidly evolving landscape of AI, voices like Professor Rutkamp Bloom's are essential to ensure that our approach to regulation is both comprehensive but nuanced. So to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Regulating AI. Until next time, this is Sanjay Puri. Keep exploring the critical questions surrounding AI governance and its impact on our shared future. Emma, thank you so much. This was fabulous. Like I said, I could have gone on. There's at least 20 other questions I had, but thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you for the conversation.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.